Friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is overcoming mental biases. A bias is prejudice, and we know how Hindus are biased towards Muslims, the white are biased towards black, dark-skinned people. Similarly, in India, we find the high caste, so to speak, Brahmins, are biased towards the untouchables or the low caste people, and vice versa. We also have bias, and these days you find it even more emphasized, the bias which men have towards women and women have towards men, and lots of WhatsApp messages come which go to show, my God, what a divide it seems to be, and each having a very, very deep-seated bias towards the other sex. So there are biases. And when you say bias or prejudice, we know it doesn't allow you to see things or people as they are. And sometimes in the interpersonal relationship, there is a bias for another person. It might be some very trivial incident, and maybe at that time the person was not in a proper frame of mind, the circumstances were such because of which it happened, but you carry it with you for God knows how many years. And all the time in the interaction with the person, in the treatment of the person, the bias at the back is going to influence our action or interaction with the person. So, rightly they say that our prejudices, they are like pyramids upside down. Just think about it. It's a very vivid image. A pyramid upside down, it is resting on a very tiny tip. So also the prejudice rests on a tiny trivial incident, but then they grow upwards and outwards till they fill our mind. This is what is a bias or a prejudice, especially in the interpersonal relation. But then there is also a bias, by which we mean a particular kind of mental leaning. When we are trying to understand something, when we are trying to learn something, when we are trying to look at an object or a person, there is a mental leaning, which is what we call bias. So we do talk about people being optimistic and pessimistic. And we say, typically, that if you have a glass of water which is filled only half, an optimist will say, oh, the glass is half full. The pessimist will say, the glass is half empty. Now this is, in a way, quite a thing we have accepted. But it's deeper implication if you see. And the student is reminded of one other little, very little story, or one can say the way in which it goes, that there is a person who has 6 jars which are filled with 100 gold coins each. The 7th jar has got 99 gold coins. Only one is less. Here you see a bias. The way we were talking about the optimist and a pessimist in a very different sense. The person is worried all the time, it says, about the last jar which has 99 gold coins, one is less. So the whole of his life he is struggling, worrying, when can I get one gold coin so that I can make it 100? Okay, is it greed or is it something more? We would say it's something more. It's the way in which we also look at our own lives. Forget about the jar and the money and the greed or whatever it is. But apply it to yourself, and are we also not in the same position sometimes? A bias wherein you look at only the thing which you don't have and sideline all those things which you have. You look at your health, you look at the money you have, you look at the position and power you have. You've got education, you have intelligence. But there might be one little thing which you may be missing. It may be that you are married but you don't have a child. It may be that you are not getting married. Or it may be that you are not getting promotion in the office. There are these little things, and you see that the person is more concentrated about that one thing than enjoying and making the most of what he has. So let's see what raw material we have, and from that raw material let's see how we are going to build our life out of it. This is what is also a bias, and it all depends upon, as that person says, I cried for boots till I saw a man who had no legs. Are we going to be like that? Going on crying for boots till our eyes are opened by seeing someone who has no legs, looking down and seeing that how comfortable, how happy we are, except for that one or two things which are missing in my life? Or are we going to be making ourselves unhappy about what we don't have? This also is a mindset and a bias. Of course, there is a bias in one sense where you are looking at what Mr. Judge or Crosby says, taking up the concept of man, deity and nature. Again, this is at a higher level. And yet, we do see how it matters. As Sri B.P. Wadia says, you ask someone to describe what is man to him, and it will differ from person to person depending upon his background. Ask a scientist, and then again, if he is a physicist or a biologist or a physiologist, he will say or give a definition which will differ. For a physicist, what is man? His body, and therefore he is a bundle of atoms and molecules. A biologist will say, what is man? And he'll say, he is an agglomeration of cells. Go to a psychologist and he will say, man is id, ego and superego. Go to a theologian and he will say, man is a soul. And let him really worry about it, because he can lose his soul, so let him do prayers and worship and so on. Come to a person who understands spiritual kind of a outlook about man, and he will say, what is man? His body, his soul and his mind. So we can see that here also it will depend upon a bias. Is a mental leaning, and the mental leaning is based on what are our previous concepts, what has been our education and so on. Also, there is another very important bias, and that is for a common man. General thing is, we are not interested in abstruse things, the complicated things. They will always say, "Arey, keep it simple," is a word which you keep hearing, keep it simple. So if you start out on explaining something, they will say, keep it simple, because they are not interested. So what are we interested in as common people? We are interested in our interest. So always the bottom line will be, I know you have told all that, but what is it there in it for me? What is it that is to my advantage? This is what we call utilitarian point of view. This is also a bias. There is a utilitarian point of view. So anything you see, what can I get in this situation, in this thing, in this discussion, in this knowledge? So that utilitarian point of view is also very narrowing. It is very limiting. And Sangharakshita, a Buddhist teacher, which we have shared with you before, he noticed this when he had gone to Kalimpong with a Nepalese friend. And they were taking a walk in the morning, and they came across a pine tree. And I mean, being a Buddhist teacher and also being philosophically inclined and seeing beauty in nature, he said, "Ah, is it not a beautiful tree?" And the Nepalese friend was a simple person, so he said, yeah, I see a lot of wood in that tree to last me entire winter." So Sangharakshita says he did not see the beauty of the tree at all. He saw how much wood he can get out of that pine tree so that he can burn it and use it as a fuel for the entire winter. This is what is the outlook which we have. Let's not really deny. Most of the time it is a utilitarian outlook out of which we have to come out, really. And all that happens because right from the beginning, how we have been groomed up. What is the family, parents, elders thinking about? Are they really from childhood, you've been hearing they are talking about money and property? Or are they thinking about no matter what? Family which eats together, stays together. So there is a more importance given to you, family relationships, not so much to money. Or is it that more importance is given to knowledge and intelligence? Whatever may be our background. And then whatever may be our further studies and the kind of job we take, all of that we will not read. That is the first quotation where Mr. Crosby is saying that. that what's your mindset and bias? What is it really made up of? Because right from your childhood, you have accepted things which were suggested to you. And importantly, you have accepted without finding out the basis. Have you ever questioned what is the basis for saying that God is in heaven, that God is a human being, only a gigantic being? Or if you say not that, but God is only a principle, what is the basis? We've just taken in whatever is being told. And these suggestions are now making a kind of a mental leaning in this direction or that, more in the scientific and materialistic direction rather than in a spiritual direction. So that's it. That is one thing. To this we can add, as we grow, and this is something which comes from Buddhism, a lot of influence in making our mindset and the leaning comes from the kind of profession or a job that we take up. We never paid so much attention before, but then you do the Noble Eightfold Path. And one step in the Noble Eightfold Path is called Samyak Ajivika. That is right livelihood, perfect livelihood. Now what is that item saying? Right livelihood is given importance because, again, Sangharakshita has been explaining this by saying, let us not underestimate the value of what career, what profession, what occupation you are taking up. Because imagine, even if it is something simple, those early good days when people used to be there for 8 hours in the office, in their shops or whatever they were doing, today it might extend to 10 hours, 11 hours, God knows how many hours, and very little time at home, more time in the office. So if that is the time for which you are going to be doing the same thing, as he says, that you are there doing it 8 hours a day, 5 days a week or 6 days a week, and that 52 weeks a year, and that around 20, 30 years. Just this is the Buddhist way of emphasizing how important is this particular item. So imagine doing that day in and day out. And now he says, supposing your profession happens to be that of a butcher. Leaving it aside, he wants to show two things. That whatever profession you are following, sometimes you will see it will have a very marked impact, a marked sign, even in your physical body. And so he gives example of a dyer, someone who is coloring threads, you know, they color the threads and then they are used in making the fabrics and all that. So the dyer, if you see his fingers, by doing this day in and day out, the fingers almost get a permanent color. And you see the fingers and you know, he must be a dyer. He's talking about the simple setup that they used to have in the earlier days. And then if you see someone who is the person who is a tailor, and you will find that over a period of time, because he's bending on the machine, he will have a hump. Khund nikli aave, as we say. So he will have a hump. If your profession can do this to even your physical body, how much more impact will it have on your mind? So then, take the case of butcher. You can't remain a soft-hearted person killing so many animals day in and day out. We are not saying that he will be a very cruel man. But yes, some impact will be there. That soft-heartedness will become a little hard-heartedness also. Our days, a certain Swamiji had brought this out. He going and staying with people, doing his lecture and all that. He would generally get into conversation with the youngsters in the family. So he'll say, what are you doing? And he noticed that most families are here that the youngsters are in information technology, programming, computer. And he was saying that I was just thinking, yes, very good, very intelligent, but where and in what direction the mind works? Computer and the programming. It is all more related to logic and rationality. So, if your mind for 20 years, 30 years is thinking in a logical way, any problem, anything, the first way is to solve it logically only. Any issue, anything is seen logically only. There is very little development of the heart. Somehow it is all happening only logically and rationally. But we know there cannot be life lived only logically and rationally. Where are the emotions? And the emotions will get backseat. So he says, I used to tell them that why don't you have the practice also of reading some good stories, take up good novel, read at least one or two such books, maybe in a month, maybe in 3 months, so that you know they will not be completely having a leaning which is logical and rational, but that other humane and emotional and the heart aspect also will get its development. This is very, very insightful, we would say. It is not only connected to someone who is doing the work of a butcher or someone who is in a police force. There also sometimes we wonder, the policeman doing his work, you know, where you tend to get so harsh because you deal with these criminals, and therefore no wonder they are also given meditation and things like that. So all in all, the mental leaning, one has to be very careful. We know how even those who are in the scientific field today, they are at a disadvantage if they don't complement their scientific investigations by, again, leaning to literature, spirituality and so on, as comes from someone, Jane Goodall, we are all very well aware who she is, and she is the one who did a lot for protection of wildlife. She worked with chimpanzees for many, many years. She even really campaigned that you should not use chimpanzees for experiment and all that. This is the lady who, in a way you can say, immersed in scientific field, observing animal behavior, looking at things from the scientific point of view, is the person who comes up with a very different kind of a admission. And that is, as we have shared with you before, that when she lost her husband, she was still working in Africa with the chimpanzees and so on. And in the forests of Gombe, she says, I was sitting. And I looked around me, it started raining. And then I saw rain, birds, trees, river, everything was there. Then for a few moments, I felt one. I felt oneness with the rain, with the birds on the trees, with the trees, I mean, with the animals, the chirping. I was lost. And that unity which I felt was such a different experience that she goes on to say, we will not have time to read these quotations, but you must read what she's saying. The second quotation is by her, and she's saying, there is not just one window through which you can look at the world. So long as I was working with these animals, I have been seeing at nature through the window of a scientist. It was a scientific window. So I was classifying animals, I was studying their behavior, I was classifying plants. That's all very well, but it is a window of a scientist. Today I saw nature through the window of a mystic. Only for a mystic this experience can be there. We admire, you see, many times we are told that if you want to increase impersonal moments in your life, have a practice of quietly sitting and listen to some abstruse music, you know, not with words, but without words. Some classical music, some instrumental music. Go to nature, look at sunrise, sunset. Go to nature, look at the waves in the ocean. This is one way of mystically looking at nature and sometimes realizing that I am lost. I am become so impersonal for those few moments I forgot myself. This is what is mystical. And that mystical experience in its depth was experienced by this person because she really loved nature, she really loved animals, she really felt, as much as she would feel for a human being, she felt for them. So she was given. So the whole leaning now was different. The mental leaning, which was scientific, had become a kind of a mystical leaning. Of course, talking about biases, we can say that in our days, the bias is there for appearances. HPB has a lot to say, but even the articles which come these days have a lot to say. And a few years back, not very long ago, maybe 4 or 5 years back, there was this article which, because that person called Jeremy Meek, a very handsome criminal, he was arrested because lots of burglary cases and criminality was charges were there on his head. When he was put in the prison, and this is the fact which we are sharing, lots of men and women said, he's too handsome to go to prison. He's too handsome to go to prison. And the author just puts that incident to tell us about how much we are enamored of the beauty, how much our judgment depends on beauty. So, this author is saying that for us, if the person is beautiful, whatever the beautiful person does is also good, beautiful, and correct. A beautiful person cannot do anything wrong. This is how we come to see. And lots of good-looking ones, men and women, they get away with lots of errors and wrong things just because they are beautiful, just because they are handsome. But this is our problem, not theirs. How is it that we give so much value? And so some other person is writing that if I show you a very lovely flower, but I tell you that be careful, don't smell, it is poisonous, and you will not believe me. You will say, such a beautiful flower, how can it be poisonous? You see, that's exactly what happens when we see a beautiful person. We assume and we attribute to him so many qualities which he does not have. We attribute ourselves that just because he is beautiful or handsome, he must be also this and he must be also that. And we are not willing to take the negativity about the person. So much so that the studies were carried out in UK. Two things. One, in a study they found that whenever out of 2 or 3 suspects, one of them was a good-looking person, the whole jury was positively biased towards him into thinking that he cannot be the criminal. Another study where they gave some 100 different people 20 photographs. 10 photographs were of the very good-looking people and 10 photographs of mediocre, even very dark, ugly people and so on. And they were asked that, see, we are searching for a person who has done a burglary or theft or something. And straight away those 10 good-looking people were eliminated. Then they were searching amongst those not good-looking people to see who could possibly be the criminal. You see, we are emphasizing because it has a greater implications. What is HPB saying? She, in one of her articles, is saying that this is our civilization. Our civilization is such that if you want to have success in anything, it must be built on appearances. If you want to succeed as a person, appearance. If you want to succeed in selling your goods, appearance. So what's happening? The packaging must be very attractive and good. Doesn't matter what the quality is. By and by people will realize. But first, the packaging. Similarly, people. Similarly, the pomp and show of your office, of whatever you have undertaken, the project. Appearances is what on which we build things, and appearances which we also are really, in a way, giving importance to the extent that she says, the biggest baby, the largest orchid, and something, the most beautiful woman, these are the ones which get prizes. Very rarely you hear about the most honest person getting a prize, the most truthful person getting a prize. We are putting in our own words. But she's saying that the morality takes a backseat. Now, it's not just her. A few years back when we attended a seminar, the point which was discussed was morality. And one thing that most speakers said was that this morality is not at the lowest ebb. There are people who are doing good things. They are being very upright. But it is not showcased enough. You should showcase it. You should project it. if you are projecting in the newspaper and in the books things which are of robbery, rape, criminality, why don't you equally give importance also to these things? If you showcase it, and if you say that yes, such and such a thing, only then when it is a 26th of January, a few random people here and there would get some Padma Shri or something. Why not on a monthly basis? Why not more frequently? So, then people's attention will be taken away from appearances to the depth, which is the inner nature. Not the outer beauty, but the inner beauty. So, the bias is still here. And of course, we also know that children or grown-ups, they are biased as far as the outer beauty is concerned. And that's how you see that your advertisement industry is thriving like anything. So many, always, mostly, good-looking actors, actresses, models, they come and they advertise. And they will tell you to buy a toothpaste or maybe washing powder or maybe soap, or it can be some brand of biscuit, coffee, what have you. And you may wonder whether that particular person must be using this toothpaste or this powder. Maybe not at all. And yet all the merits of it are spoken, and because it comes from the mouth of this person, you want to immediately go and buy. Are we not biased? Biased in a wrong way. Because of the appearance of the person who is advertising. Long, long time, Aldous Huxley wrote a book, Ends and Means, and there he says, please teach your child that this beautiful girl in a silk gown who is holding the toothpaste or holding a soap and saying that buy this. There is no earthly connection between merits of the soap or toothpaste and the girl in a beautiful gown, that the beautiful girl in the silk gown. Please show that there is no connection between the two. So we have taken some time in showing this is the greatest bias. We will all realize if you just sit back and see how many times we ourselves are taken in by simply the appearance and not really trying to gauge the inner but go more by the outer. This is a bias, unfortunately for us. The bias is also there about seeing things by our attachments. So there are two biases which come because of the attachment to family and the attachment to nation. So there is a narrow kind of patriotism, and there is a narrow kind of a family feeling. Very rarely are we able to look at what is done by the family members objectively. Most of the time, whatever is done, it is explained away, it is covered over, and we never try to find fault. What is it? That's the very first step we have taken in loving someone besides our own selves. So it is a very crucial thing that we stop having this bias. Because apart from loving my own self, the next, if I love, it's my family. So in expanding the circle, the next step is our family. And in that love which I have for the family, if it is a biased love, then I am not going to really make any good spiritual progress. And therefore, that article, Living the Higher Life, says that what should be your outlook or a mental setup when it comes to dealing with family members. The family members are the ones to whom two things you are supposed to in a way teach or inculcate. One, let the family members become aware of what are the drawbacks in the family. And then find out what are the strong points in my family. I think hardly ever we do that. Only sometimes when too many people tell that you people are all the same, you know, you people are very touchy. When something is told, then you see, oh yeah, somehow I think we are too very proud in some way, or very touchy because nobody can say anything about us and we can't take it. So there is pride, a very subtle but definitely pride in all the members. Another family would be too much possessive about property, money and greed and all that. Another family, and only intellectual, but very little emotion, and another family. Now, aren't we going to be not biased? If not all of us, if few of us are there, this is that article is saying, living the higher life. What can a bias do is that you will never progress. That whole family institution is for the progress of individual, in which you are supposed to show and be aware yourself as to what is my family lacking, where is it having those faults, and what is it positively having which I can emphasize. And the same goes for the nation. Much is written about patriotism. Patriotism is not blind love. Patriotism comes because my body was born in this nation, and my body and I got the support, the nurturing, the nourishment from this particular country. But it does not mean that because it is my country and I love the country and I love the country, that means it is without blemish. Just like my family, right or wrong, my nation, right or wrong. That's what they say. This is the definition of patriotism. My nation, right or wrong, is not patriotism. The patriotism is the narrow patriotism, which is a biased patriotism. The true patriotism is going to see, as Mr. Judd says, the light and shade. There are lots and lots of shades of virtue, and there are lots and lots of shades even of vice. And one vice is no better than other, but what happens? Comparing maybe England with India, or comparing India with Germany, or India with America, and then you might say that, okay, at least we, you can say a dirty country, but what about them? Array, they live a life like this, like that. They drink and they eat mutton and whatever may be in the person's mind. That means you are trying to say that all is well with India, with little dirt here and there, but everything is wrong with America. Mr. Judd says that it's like, very humorously says, that the geese in my backyard are far better than swans in the backyard of my neighbor. Now, swan is a beautiful bird, but that is sidelined. The geese which make a cackling sound, they are far better than the swans. So, this is how we look at our country vis-a-vis another country? No. See what Gandhiji says. Gandhiji says, for me, patriotism is the same as humanity. I am patriotic because I am human and humane. I will not hurt England or Germany to serve India. And a patriot is so much the less patriot if he is a lukewarm humanitarian. So, patriotism is a stepping stone to becoming a humanitarian. From being citizen of India, I am going to one day become citizen of the whole world and therefore accept all of humanity. This is another bias that we will have to get over. Come to the bias, which is the most important. And that is the bias when it comes to getting spiritual teachings. People coming to theosophy. And the most problematic thing is that when they come, as we would say, they come with their own baggage. They come with their own bias, including us. That's why HVB says that what I want in the students is unbiased and clear judgment. Because all the students, they are the product of some religion, some educational background, some culture, some caste, some nationality, and they are going to be having inherently in them some preconceptions, mental dealings, predispositions, and that's what they will bring with them in judging the teachings, in judging other people. And that is a big hurdle. So, when you come to theosophy and you are given books, you read them. And as Mr. Judge is writing in one of his articles, then I would ask them. They will ask me for more books and more books, and I say, you read Key to Theosophy, you read this, and what did you get? And mostly the things that he will say is, are the things with which he is familiar, in which he believes. What has he got? He's got nothing out of theosophy. If he believed in personal God, When he comes to the section where HPB says, prayer kills self-reliance, there is no personal God, he would have skipped that and read on. Is that really going to help the person? So, the bias is not going to get you the right teachings if you already carry certain preconceived notions and then try the teachings which are given by maybe theosophy or maybe by Vedas or Upanishads. You will be carrying the bias and seeing and reading accordingly. The bias could be also, and this happens too frequently in theosophy, one person is biased towards morality and ethics, the other towards metaphysics. When you talk ethics, there is all the interest. The immediately metaphysics comes, the abstruse things, "Arey Baba, don't give that high-flying things. I am the down-to-earth person. I like to make application of things and I will not be interested in metaphysics." Or if it is metaphysical person, he will say, "We know all that." Sometimes when they come to theosophy, people are also doing that. Because they have some background of karma and rebirth, and if one or two lectures happen to be in that line, they say, "Ye sab suna hai, we know it." Have you given enough time? So the bias is a mind which is already coming prepared, thinking that I think I almost know what the philosophy is all about. This is another kind of bias. The know-all kind of bias, having read a few books, which also is very, I think, detrimental to a person. Not having metaphysical leaning, in quite a different way, Sri B.P. Wadia is encouraging metaphysics must be taken up. So, the bias on either side will not do. If I am only up in the air, then I will get a good waking up from William Judge, who says that I find these students always discussing metaphysics and they go to the heights where they are themselves not comfortable. Some questions are asked, a little difference between Parabrahm, Mula Prakriti, races, rounds. They talk and then when the questions comes, they feel very uncomfortable because they are not well grounded. It is an abstruse thing which you don't have to day in and day out discuss. Why don't they give to people what he calls ABC of theosophy? But on the other hand, there also comes a time when ABC of theosophy has been done. Also now you want a rational explanation. Religion is doing that. You should speak the truth, you should be honest, and then we ask why. Not all religions, we won't blame the religion. We will blame those who are the expounders of it have not taken enough interest. So they will not be able to tell you why you should not find fault. Why should not there be any gossip? And then that is the answer you are going to get if you get into metaphysics. So metaphysics is not all only in the air. Some amount of metaphysics is necessary to give you the basis for ethics. Some amount of metaphysics is necessary to tell you you are not isolated from other people, from the cosmos, from the planets. There is a very intimate interrelationship between every person with other people and with the whole of cosmos. And sevenfold man, sevenfold cosmos. So, Vadiaji says that this whole bird of spiritual life will not take flight in the air unless it has two wings, ethics and metaphysics. And that is both given in the secret doctrine. A time comes when a student will have to, he says, make friends with the secret doctrine, whether he likes it or not. And you may wonder, in what way is it helping? I'm still groping. And he says, it is written in a manner so that your intuition can be aroused. The faculty which gets very little exercise when you do all your university and school studies and even your office work, no matter how intellectual, the intuition gets maximum exercise and scope for developing is when we try grappling with this, which is metaphysics, which is there in the secret doctrine. So he says, let's not really be biased and think, what will it do? And he gives a very nice analogy. You eat junk food, you eat good food, You eat all kinds of food. Do you really sit and wonder, now what has happened to the food I have eaten? You don't even know. Some has got converted into blood, some into bone, some into mucus, some into tissues. You don't know what has happened. The same thing. When you take metaphysical study also, which part of your inner being has been really given exercise and strengthened, you have no idea. That is the reason why he is saying that without a bias, and the bias could also be that I, so-and-so, who has done a lot of research work in science, that used to be the case in HPB's time, and then they will come and kind of have an argument, how can theosophy say this, whereas science says this. So the bias will create a lot of cross currents. There will be lots of cross currents created, and they will end up not getting what spiritual science is telling them, and which may be different from what the physical science is telling them. The same thing is true when we hear another person telling about his own religion. It is also true when we hear our own student from the platform, and another kind of bias comes because you feel we have heard this before. Or you don't get along with that student well, this is not me, but William Judge saying, you are mentally switched off because maybe you don't like the pronunciation, maybe you don't like the way of exposition, maybe something else. But you are missing out something, and that what you are missing out, when you don't hear out a person from another religion telling you about the same thing which theosophy tells, what you are missing out is the viewpoint. Seeing the same idea from another's eye. Seeing life through another's eye, through another philosophy, through another person. So, that another viewpoint you have very sorely missed out. Because each one of us has a limited viewpoint, and this is put nowhere so well as has been put in Jainism. We have shared with you this before, but I think it's a marvelous idea. Jainism tells you about what is called Anekantavad. Anekantavad simply says that everything, and especially the truth, has multiplicity of aspects, multiplicity of facets, and no one person can take in all aspects or all facets, even of an object, leave alone the truth. Typical example, you have a silver jug. Some person will describe and will give you a few characteristics. Oh, it is narrowing at the top, then broad at the base, very secure base, a broad base, silver, then there is air inside. Some more. Then a clairvoyant might tell you a kind of a sukshma deha, the astral of the psychometer will touch the jug and say the jug was bought in such and such a year from such and such a shopkeeper. We are just exaggerating it. But just see, what we are trying to say is that that's what Jainism is saying. Any object, each person has a limitation to know about that object. Know even about a person. Interesting that Professor C.S. Lewis says A, B, C are the three friends. A will reveal something of himself to B, but not all of it. A will reveal something else to C, but not all of it. And C will have some inner sight so that he knows more about A than B can have about A. Similarly, C doesn't have the same insight which A has about, and so on. Very true, isn't it? Each one of us knows about the same person. So many different aspects are there, and we cannot say, I know him inside out. Sometimes we tend to say like that, "Arre, I know that person, what he will do. I know him thoroughly," but we are mistaken. A person is changing, and also the person is, what you know is only 1/10 of the person. The 9/10 of him you don't know. Like that also here, what they say is that if that happens with a person, with the object, how much more true it is regarding the truth. The truth has many facets, many aspects. And therefore, no one person, unless he happens to be an omniscient, all-knowing seer, he can say, I know it in totality. But otherwise, the famous story, a very vividly explaining thing, is six blind men trying to understand what an elephant is. One catches hold of his leg and says, the elephant is like a pillar. The other catches hold of the tail and says, it's like a rope. The third takes the trunk and says, it's like a horse pipe. The other touches the ears and says, oh, it's like a winnowing basket, like a supri and all that. Is anyone right completely? No. From each one, from his own viewpoint, he's right. Elephant is like a pillar and this and that in one aspect. And the six blind men are the six schools of Indian philosophy, which we call Shadadarshan. Each one has tried to explain the Brahman, the Vishwa, the world, from their own point of view. And Theosophy says, Theosophy is the seventh darshana. It gives a kind of a synthetic view of things. And yet, each one of them is right. Each one is having a partial view. So, the Jainas will say, there is something called Nayavad. Nayavad says that my judgment and his judgment, and there are so many judgments, but each judgment is a limited judgment. And therefore, they have another thing called Syadvad, that every judgment must be qualified with the word Syad. Syad means it may be so. From one point of view, it is so. That is Syad. That is not like saying, I know it all. I think it is so from one point of view, but if you say so, I accept it. From another point of view, it may be what you are saying. So also each of the religion, Theosophy would say, is having a partial truth. Each is true from their own point of view, and therefore, the thing which Mr. Judge is saying, don't get overshadowed by any person, by any religion, by any ism, by any philosophy. But also don't be too overconfident to brush it aside. As HPB says, Narada says, I do not know it, so therefore it cannot be. Because one must study to know to understand, and understand to judge. Therefore, I will keep aside something which another person says, it doesn't gel well with me. I am coming from a Western background, where right from childhood I have not been told about rebirth. I can't come to Theosophy and say, of course there is no rebirth. I'm missing something. I would say I'll keep it aside. And then as he says, unripe fruit get ripe. As I rise in my level of perception, I will understand one day, yes, it is possible. At least rationally I can accept there is rebirth. Now this judgment of other people and other religions, if we have to keep aside the mental bias of my judgment being true, how much more it will be so when we try to pit our tiny judgment against that of divine judgment. The divine judgment is not of God but of the law, and that's the law of karma. Many, many times when things happen to us, when there is suffering, when there is calamity, when there is adversity, and the judgment comes, there is no justice in the world. I don't know for what I am suffering so much. And if we know the cause, we may feel, array, but for that much, so much suffering. There is a judgment which almost tries to say, the law doesn't know what it has given me. And someone has given a very beautiful thing where the mother is doing embroidery. And you know, those who have done it will know, and especially if you are not too good, in school we used to have, if you see it from below, it will be a tangle of threads. On the top side, it will be a beautiful design. But as you take the threads, then sometimes you have to break. It will be a very messy thing. So this is saying that the child was playing on the ground and looking. Mother is doing embroidery and she says, Mom, what are you doing? I see only a tangle of threads, nothing. Mom said, wait, go play for some time and come. By then she has finished. Then she takes the child on the lap and shown the embroidery, and now it makes a beautiful thing. Maybe she has made a puppy or maybe she has made a flower. And he says, yes, beautiful colors, beautiful design. But from below, it was not so. So we are told. From our point of view, it's a big mess, tangle. We can't understand life and the happenings of life. And we make a judgment. This is not right. It ought not to have happened. Ought to have happened. It's more, it's less. But then as years pass, we will all agree. In the hindsight, we get the view which the child had by sitting in the lap of the mother somehow. And you say, it's all fine. Had that thing not happened that day, I would not be where I am today. This happens. There's a whole article somebody had written interviewing 10 people. And it's called The Other Side of Happiness. And very interesting, we read each one having gone through the worst in life. Someone had a sudden kind of a downfall from riches to rags. Some person had suffered a lot from a terminal illness and came out of it. Some other person had a very bad family life and came out of it. And each one, are these people, no complaint, but saying, thank God for that today I am saying, that I passed through it and that's why I am what I am today. This is another kind of happiness. See, the happiness which comes when all is going smoothly, we are all aware of it. Everything is comfortable, the relationships are smooth. But this is other side of happiness. The happiness which now I have, having overcome the obstacle, having accepted it, having learned from it and triumphed over it, is the happiness which is of a totally different kind. This is also therefore to be kept in mind. Now my judgment is very different from the judgment when I just discovered that I have maybe paralysis or cancer or whatever. I go through it, bear it, learn and say, happier that I had. Time is more than run out. So, yes, this is biases and it's very important to know because it is the bias which is going to make your mind full of dust. There is a dust of attachment, dust of bias, dust of ignorance. And as our reading says, if you really, really want the atmic light to shine and if you want to develop intuition full-fledged, the mirror must be clean and one great big puddle of dust is bias, the mental leaning, prejudice. If you clean, the mirror also becomes clean. We have two questions of which we will take only one question. And it says that due to dominance of desire nature, second question, most of us are either living in it or surrounded by people with similar tendencies. That means people are just going after satisfying of desires, running after material things. Today I brought a dress, tomorrow I want a new car, tomorrow I worry about my bungalow or flat or whatever. So we are moving around with people like that. How can one train one's mind to not get affected but stick to being humane? So it's like saying, how do I not get affected by desire? And of course, as so many times, this has been brought out, very small section, maybe half a page, entitled Desire Made Pure. Desire is not to be destroyed. We require this desire even to become someone better. As Mr. Jat says, from a sinning mortal, if you want to become like Buddha, one day, that desire must arise in you, just like in Buddha who was only a sweeper. When he saw another Buddha, Dipankara, going on the street, he said, one day I want to become like him. Look at the calmness this person has. So that was a desire. So we are only going to transmute desire, not really going to destroy it. The transmutation of desire is not to be done, as Buddha himself says, by some kind of jabarjasti. Not go on suppressing, repressing with a very powerful will. With the same pressure that you have pressed, it will come up when the conditions are right. So then, how do you train your mind? It is something where you just try and practice detachment in small things of life. I think last Sunday also we were seeing something about asceticism, and it was brought out. Asceticism is not really fasting, torturing the body, but when life brings something, you enjoy. When life takes away that thing, you don't grumble. This is how you can become detached. If you become detached in small things, you will slowly learn to become detached in greater things. And that is something which is done in two ways. One, as desire made pure is saying, we have desire beginning with the grosser things. First, it is wealth, position, power, fame, name, knowledge, and then last, love. The first few things and the others will come when you have experiences. So, it says only one line. Don't worry. Life will teach you. Life has ways of teaching how to get over the desire. We know that friend's example. She would always want to go out. Come vacation and she will want to go. What would happen? The husband in a big position, everything backpacked, ready to go. Last moment, sorry, we can't go. Urgent work has come. And she would be like completely for 5 days in a kind of a depression. It happened once, twice, thrice, 5 times. Then we asked her, now what? Arey, che, ata kaij vatat nahi. We are purposely giving small example. We are not saying big desires. This also is a desire that I have to have a vacation, I have to go out, or I have to have this, that and the other, this kind of food and this kind of comfort. What happens? There is something which happens in life and it happens over and over again. And then you know, what is it trying to teach me? Probably this detachment. If you are open enough, if you are awake enough, you will learn the lesson. And then, as Buddha says, like a ripe fruit falls from a tree, the desire is dropped. You don't even know, because so many experiences along that line that you just learn the lesson. Or you run after something and after having achieved, you feel, oh, what is it? Being CEO of the company, there are lots of problems, lots of different kinds of people to handle, income tax, this, that. What was I running after? It all turns to dust and ashes in the mouth. The desire will, to 50%, it would be gone. You see, it would be overcome. And yet there is another way. And that other way is what we were seeing on Friday. What did first shloka say in the 9th chapter? I'm going to teach you now that kingly knowledge and kingly science which will help you to overcome evil. And we saw evil is what? Desires, sanskaras, vasanas. How will that Atmagnan do it? The moment, side by side with your worldly life, you start acquiring knowledge and start practicing what little you can, and along with that, start practicing meditation. And what is it? Read any good religious book. You take a book in Buddhism, you take a book in Jainism, you take a book in Hinduism. And you will be, especially the Buddhists, they do tell you what are the benefits of regularly meditating and so on. One thing glaringly, and this is a self-experience which people have, the moment you have started living this life, it shows its results. And what are the results? And especially of a genuine study, genuine reflection, genuine application and genuine meditation. The results are that now, instead of being very gregarious, going to clubs and parties, always want to be in the crowd, you want seclusion and solitude. Two, your very psychic nature gets refined. Gone are those desires for have to go to a movie and have to have this channel in the television, have to go for this food and this joint, and and have to, that the psychic nature was feeding on, is now not gone, but now your desire nature is looking for something of a finer variety. You listen to music, but something which is more of a classical shade rather than the tom-tom music. You are now more interested in sitting quietly and watching sunset or sunrise. You are more interested in a horticulture, pot culture, and you are more interested in all those, the refined thing which your psychic nature will need. Did you do anything? Nothing really. The running and every Saturday buying a new dress is gone. That so many pairs of shoes is gone. Going out is gone. And you don't know how did it all drop. A point comes when certain kind of food we lose interest in. So also these desires. We have taken time, but it's very, very important. If you just start this, don't worry about how will we do. The desires will take care of themselves. And the last important thing that is said is, then you don't worry whether the pleasures are there or not there. When they are there, you'll enjoy. When they are not there, you won't even feel that they are not there. Oh, the TV is not working since last 10 days. Okay, I'll read the book. The book is taken away. Okay, maybe I'll do something in the kitchen. You have not become dependent. This is, shall we say, a great advantage of sincerely trying to pursuing what big name we give to spiritual discipline. We are sorry, we have taken long time.